Good morning and welcome to our 2018 half-year results presentation. This morning I'll take you through the highlights. Jeff will take you through the financial results and divisional performance in more detail, and then I will return to discuss some of the broader strategic themes and our outlook. Today, I'd like to start by thanking my colleagues, our management team, and all our employees for their hard work and collaboration in delivering these results. Across all of our divisions, we have a stronger management team than I have ever seen at any time since joining Legal & General. All of my colleagues are performing at a higher level. Our industrial scale-up has succeeded, and we're now building a technologically scaled-up business. The usual disclaimers apply. This was another 6 months of strong performance from Legal & General. The investments we have made set us up for a very busy H2 and are in line with our financial and growth ambitions for 2016 to 2020. On the slide here, we've excluded last year's £126 million mortality release from the comparisons, as we had no equivalent for H1 2018. The next mortality release in H2 is expected to be higher than last year's total of £332 million. Operating profit from divisions at £1.059 billion was up 7% versus half-year 2017. Solvency II operational surplus generation of £700 million was 11% up on the prior year. Earnings per share at 13 pence were lower than the prior year due to the decrease in investment variance of £142 million from £175 million to £33 million. And our interim dividend of 4.6p is also 7% up versus last year, consistent with our policy. Stepping back, we see operating profit from divisions, which was £1.1 billion in 2011, growing at 10% per annum since 2011. EPS over the same period is growing, again, at 10% per annum. This strong growth trajectory is without including the effects of last year's mortality release. And looking at dividend per share, I've included data in the slide back to 2007. We see the same steady progression in growth at 10%. It is worth noting operating profits were £658 million back in 2007. Now, after a decade of growth, they're over £2 billion. Looking at the double-digit compound growth in operating profit from divisions, from dividends per share, and earnings per share over the longer term is instructive. During this period, we have had numerous and plenty of exogenous challenges, including Solvency II, pensions freedom, thematic reviews, the Brexit referendum, interest rates falling. In each case, having a clear strategy and focus and the ability to implement management actions has enabled Legal & General to deliver a steady drumbeat of rising operating profits, earnings per share, and rising dividends. The interim dividend for H1 2018 of 4.6p is up by 7% from 4.3p last year. It's set in accordance with our formula. So no change to our approach of measured progression, which provides a high level of predictability for our investors. Jeff will cover the balance sheet in more detail. But in summary, we see here the consistent effect of growing operational surplus generation. We have written significant volumes of new annuity business the last few years, while the SCR has in fact reduced from 8.3 billion to 7.4 billion. And through small or negative new business strain, delivered consistent net surplus generation. The S2 coverage ratio continues to strengthen, and at the end of June was 193% compared with 186% a year ago. The longevity release we expect to make in H2 will provide additional capital for Legal & General. This snapshot of operating profit by business division shows the positive momentum from H1 2017 to H1 2018 across every business division, except general insurance. Never have we had so many opportunities to grow. Never have we had such a strong management team to deliver that growth. We now need to execute. And H2 has got off to an excellent start, with more to follow in the rest of the year and beyond. Our businesses and their profits are aligned to structural growth drivers in the broader economy. Over the next 20 years, the UK population aged 65 to 84 is estimated to grow by almost 40%. This aging demographic in the UK underpins a PRT market which is busier than ever, with an active quote levels at over £20 billion in a market where pricing factors are moving in favour of deal execution. We have over £7 billion expected to complete in H2 2018. We expect a record year in 2018. We also expect strong double-digit growth in retail retirement products to continue in H2 and beyond. In housing, Cala and our other housing businesses are just reaching scale in a market which is still well short of the target 300,000 homes per year. In investment management, we are leading the shift towards DC. We're strong in global LDI and fixed income, and we expect to see further US and international growth in H2 and beyond. In the insurance businesses, markets and weather conditions have been difficult, but our management actions are turning around previous areas of underperformance, moving customer acquisition increasingly to direct and employing digital to improve product, pricing, and service. Our confident outlook suggests that we will again outperform in H2 and beyond, enabling us to achieve our targeted EPS performance out to 2020. I'm very positive about H2 and the years to come. Now, I'd like to hand over to Jeff.
Thank you, Nigel. Morning, everyone. I'm not going to use Nigel's glasses either. This morning, I'm going to cover the financials for the first half of the year, where we are investing, the performance of each of our divisions, and finally, the group's capital position. As Nigel said earlier, we have been consistent in our delivery, and the first half has been no exception. Our operating profit from divisions is up 7%, with growth in five of our six businesses, which demonstrates the quality of our divisions and the relevance of our focused long-term strategy. This growth rate excludes the first half 2017 mortality release of £126 million. This is consistent with how we presented the full-year results. All comparisons I make to half-year metrics will be excluded in this mortality release, unless otherwise stated. We are using some of these mortality releases and strong profits to invest in high-growth opportunities within our chosen markets. As previously flagged, we are making measured investments across our group to drive cost efficiencies, gain access to growth areas, enhance customer experience, and to comply with evolving regulatory framework. In the first half of 2018, on top of the investment within divisions, this resulted in a £13 million increase in group investment spend, meaning operating profit was up 5%. PBT was down largely as a result of lower investment variance compared to the first half of last year, due to adverse equity market performance and lower long-term interest rates impacting LGI reserves. Net release from continuing operations was down slightly to £658 million, primarily due to lower new business surplus from LGR. Our return on equity remains above 20%, illustrating the efficiency of our balance sheet. Now we'll turn to operating profit from divisions. In the first half, LGR's institutional business, which deals with corporate pension schemes, grew 8%. This was as a result of larger opening position and continued stable unwind of prudent margins. Our retail LGR business grew 11%. LGIM grew 5% and maintained a leading cost-income ratio of 51% whilst continuing to invest. This was despite challenging markets. LGC was up 21% following a strong performance from our £2 billion direct investment portfolio, which included an additional contribution from Cala Homes following the full acquisition in March. LGI contributed £154 million, up 5% from the prior year, following the turnaround of group protection, which returned to profitability, and continued good performance in our UK retail protection business. This was partly offset by adverse mortality experience in the US, where the market was impacted by an exceptionally bad flu season. General insurance was down due to the adverse weather experience, in particular the freeze in Q1. This was consistent with the wider market. Our diversified business model means that we can manage temporary fluctuations across the group and still deliver attractive returns to our investors. and a quick update on the disposals we've recently announced. Mature savings expected to complete in 2019 following the past seven transfer. In the first half, we recognised 56 million operating profit from this business, comprising the unwind of the expected underlying profits and a one-off release of £33 million provision, which is no longer required following the transaction. In June, we announced an agreement to sell our stake in India First, resulting in pre-tax profit of around £45 million on completion. This is expected by the year end. I'll talk in more detail about each of our divisions shortly, but first I'd like to cover our investment in the business, which we referenced at our full year results. We are well placed to invest in future growth with our robust balance sheet, cash position, ongoing mortality releases, and strong ROE. The investments we are making achieve four objectives: improve operational efficiencies through technology investments, access growing markets through bolt-on M&A, enhance the customer experience, and meet evolving regulatory standards. In technology, we are investing across the group. For example, in LGIM, we are focusing on DC pensions and personal investing. In LGR, we are partway through a multi-year technology project, modernizing our platforms in preparation for significant PRT activity expected in coming years. In GI, SmartQuote has revolutionized the quoting process, and SmartClaim helps streamline the claims process for customers. We are investing more in robotics across the group, both in customer-facing operations and finance functions. Examples of M&A investment are Canvas, Buddies, and Salary Finance. Our regulatory spend has increased to reflect changes such as IFRS 17, GDPR, and MiFID II. We continue to deliver these as efficiently as possible. We have collaborated across divisions to ensure a seamless offering for our customers on platforms like legalandgeneral.com and MyAccount. And of course, focusing on the latest advances in cybersecurity to keep our data secure. Our investment in the business will help us deliver our long-term growth objectives. Returning to the division and LGR. In the first half, operating profit was up 9% to £480 million, following a strong performance from the back book and positive operating variance, partly driven by the acceleration of fully processing PRT scheme data. As I mentioned at our year-end results, we are currently investigating the appropriateness of moving to CMI 16. Our latest estimate of this is a reserve release at the higher end of a £300 to £400 million range under IFRS and Solvency II, as we adjust our best estimate assumptions. We will continue our analysis and expect to make any changes for year-end following completion of this work. Looking at new business in more detail, we wrote nearly £1.1 billion of annuity premium in the first half, including the innovative transaction with the BAA pension scheme. In LGRI, US pension risk transfer business more than doubled premiums in the first half, and we expect this positive momentum to continue into the second half of the year, as this is when we have historically seen more activity in the US. Since we started in the market 3 years ago, we have written almost $2 billion of annuity premiums. In the UK, the bulk annuity market has been attracting headlines recently for a record pipeline. We are currently pricing more than 20 billion of live transactions, as Nigel said. We have retained a significant portion of the 2017 warehouse direct investments and added to this to support higher second half volumes that we mentioned earlier. Moving on to retail business, individual annuity sales were slightly down at £337 million. As last year benefited from increased H1 sales during a catch-up period at the start of the Aegon distribution agreement. We continue to see demand returning to the individual annuity market, and in the second quarter, we saw a 16% increase in premiums compared to the same period last year. We are the leader in lifetime mortgages with a 28% market share, having written £521 million in loans in the first half, up 23%. We remain positive about the potential in the second half of the year. Although we are market leaders, we are recent entrants, so lifetime mortgages only represent 5% of our £56 billion annuity portfolio. There's been a lot of talk in the market following the PRA's recent consultation on the use of lifetime mortgages to back annuity liabilities. We will, of course, be working with our industry peers to respond to the consultation. but our view is that we have a robust capital treatment for lifetime mortgages and a relatively small exposure. So we believe any change from this new consultation will not be material to our capital position. In short, the second half holds a lot of promise for LGR, with a strong new business pipeline and positive momentum. Within our annuity asset portfolio, we continue to maintain a high credit quality, with approximately two-thirds rated A or better, 19% of which is in sovereign-like investments. We are continuing to increase our allocation to direct investments, and these now make up 19% of our asset portfolio. On this slide, we've provided a list of some of our largest direct investments. As you can see, we focus on securing long-term rental income from high-quality tenants, with our largest exposure being over £1 billion to the UK government, primarily through HMRC. Now let's move to LGIM, who were the focus of our capital markets event in June. LGIM has shown consistent growth, with operating profit up 5% to £203 million. Driven by higher AUM at the start of the year and increased revenues from flows. This was partially offset by the impact from adverse markets on management fee growth and continued investment in the business. We've maintained a stable cost-income ratio of around 50% due to the scalable nature of our business model, and fund performance continues to be strong. External net flows were £14.6 billion, with good performance across regions, channels, and product lines. This excludes £2.4 billion of AUM, which moved to LGIM as part of the Canvas acquisition. In the first half, we saw positive flows from our DC, retail, and international businesses, which helped offset the structural shift from our UK DB index business as our clients continue to de-risk. We talked about this trend in June, and as an example, we flagged one large outflow of £6 billion from a local authority scheme. UKDC had a great performance, and we maintained our market leadership while building the largest and fastest-growing master trust. In retail, our rapid growth has continued into the first half of the year, and AUM up 17% to more than £25 billion. International AUM increased by 16%, and this now makes up nearly a quarter of our assets. At our capital markets event, we talked about LGIM's three strategic themes. Firstly, we have continued to broaden our investment capabilities, building on our core strengths. This includes expanding into Europe with ETFs, offering real assets, which are in high demand by pension schemes, and packaging our responsible investing capabilities into our Future World funds. Secondly, we are addressing the savings gap. Much of our growth in this area is in retail and in DC, where we now have over 2.8 million customers. Thirdly, we are expanding internationally as we export our core strengths. We have had success in our carefully chosen markets within the US, Europe, and Asia, and we see a strong pipeline for the second half of the year. As we have previously stated, LGIM's operating profit growth target is 8 to 10% over the medium term. Moving on, LGC continues to grow profits as we diversify and expand the assets we invest in. Operating profit was up 21% to £172 million, following a strong performance from the direct investment portfolio, and also benefiting from the additional contribution from Cala Homes. It should be remembered that due to the seasonal nature of housing, Cala experiences higher profitability in the first half of the year. PBT was £82 million, down from £194 million in the prior year, with lower equity returns resulting in negative investment variance in the traded portfolio. Direct investments achieved a net portfolio return of 9.1%. The portfolio is now over £2 billion, and in the first half of the year, LGC invested or committed over £700 million into new opportunities, as well as into existing asset classes. This included the launch of affordable housing and further investment into build-to-rent fund with LGIM Real Assets. Through the creation of real assets, urban regeneration, and clean energy investments, we are rebuilding UK cities, generating stable returns for shareholders, MA-eligible assets for LGR, and attractive assets for LGIM clients. We will continue to expand into cities where we do not yet have a presence. The traded and treasury assets portfolio was £6.1 billion and includes cash holdings of £4.1 billion, up from £3.4 billion at the year end. This is mostly due to the receipt of proceeds from Swiss Re for mature savings. Our protection division, LGI, had an improved performance in the first half of the year. Operating profit increased 5%. However, there are a couple of moving parts to highlight here. In the UK, our leading retail protection business reported good profit growth, with some one-off model enhancements offsetting adverse lapse experience and lower product margins in a competitive market. As previously guided, group protection returned to profitability following management actions taken to address adverse claims experience. Total UK protection premiums increased 3%, and our direct distribution channel again performed strongly, accounting for 21% of retail new business APE. In the US, operating profit was down $48 million to $24 million, largely due to the higher-than-expected claims in the first half, compared to favorable mortality experience in the prior year. This adverse experience was due to elevated cases of flu in line with the market, wider market. Assuming constant FX rates, US premiums grew 3%, and the business remains the second largest provider of US term life assurance through the broker channel. GI made an operating loss of £6 million in the first half, primarily as a result of the adverse weather experience in line with the market with the Q1 freeze. Excluding the freeze impacts, operating profit would have been up £7 million to £22 million, and the combined operating ratio 92%, highlighting underlying progress in the business. Gross premiums increased 12% to £193 million, whilst maintaining our pricing discipline in a competitive market. The division is also becoming increasingly diversified, with our pet insurance business gathering momentum. Overall, 37% of our premium now comes from our direct channel, demonstrating the returns on our investments in technology. GI has had 8 distribution agreements with major UK financial institutions go live since the start of 2016, including 2 new partnerships in the first half of this year. We remain in active discussions with potential new distribution partners who value our smart quote and award-winning smart claim propositions. These factors combine to give good prospects for growth in the second half and beyond. Moving on to our capital position, the group's Solvency II surplus stands at £6.9 billion. Our Solvency II coverage ratio increased to 193%, up from 189% at year-end. Due to the increased understanding of and focus on Solvency II, we no longer intend to publish our economic capital coverage ratio. We retain EC for internal management purposes, and for those of you that are interested, the coverage ratio at the end of June continues to be around 60% higher than the Solvency II ratio shown here. We have bridged the Solvency II surplus to help explain the movement since the year end. Operational surplus generation was £0.7 billion. Up 11% on the prior year. This already covers the larger of the 2 dividends paid each year. New business strain in the first half was around £100 million. As per last year, the majority of this figure was in respect of our US term sales, which we reinsure and finance in the second half, significantly reducing the eventual strain from this business. Operating variances during this period included a number of minor movements which net to zero. And finally, on Solvency II, our usual slide gives you our estimate of the present value of Solvency II surplus emergence from the key elements of new business we wrote. As we have consistently noted, our margins are resilient. We continue to maintain pricing discipline. In LGR, the new business margin was slightly higher than usual at 10.3%. As you know, we wrote fewer deals in the first half. Therefore, this is not a true representation of our expected full-year margins. In LGI, the new business margin was 7.1%, reflecting product mix changes and the impact of competitive pressures in the retail protection market. So to conclude, our business produced a solid performance in the first half, with operating profit from divisions up 7%. The group continues to achieve an ROE of over 20%, and our healthy solvency and cash positions provide further optionality to continue growing in what we believe will be an exciting second half of the year, with many opportunities. I'll now hand back to Nigel to go into more detail on a number of high growth areas across the group.
Thank you, Jeff. You'll now be familiar with the way we describe our three core businesses: investing in annuities, investment management, and insurance, and the divisional structure that sits beneath it. For the next few slides, I'll talk about the implementation of strategy in those three areas. The strategic thinking outlined here should be familiar to all of you. Our alignments to these six structural drivers of growth is, however, worth repeating because the growth drivers continue to work for us. One, aging demographics underpin pension risk transfer. We are confident of executing a further $7 billion in H2 of this year. As pension deficits shrink, so demand grows as more schemes reach the point where buy-in or buy-out becomes economically priced for them. The aging demographic also drives lifetime mortgages, where the market was about $1.6 billion in 2015 when we started. It is now about $4 billion and is expected to be $6 billion by 2020. Two, globalization of asset markets, where LGIM's international AUM has grown by 22% compound since 2014, and where we will expand from our low base into Asia and extend our reach in Europe, including through ETFs. Three, in real assets, the LGC direct investment portfolio grew 49% in H1 2018. Housing and infrastructure are key political challenges to the UK, but ones where legal in general can make a good economic return. Four, welfare reform, where, for example, the move to auto-enrollment has contributed to a 21% increase in LGIM's workplace customers, part of a 15% increase in DC, where AUM is now a market-leading £72 billion. Five, technology is improving customer service and customer value. I will return to this later. We are scaling our businesses successfully using technology, as Jeff mentioned, but we have significant further opportunities to improve. Six, and the need for today's capital evidence itself in our 200 VC investments and the growth of our Pemberton funds to almost €3 billion. This is a new slide which helps illustrate the way we think about long-term growth for Legal & General. There are three broad categories of the business: startups, scale-ups, and grown-ups. In summary, our grown-up businesses, as Jeff discussed, are performing incredibly well. These grown-ups are our largest businesses, 100% owned, typically with leading or at least substantial market share. They're innovative and entrepreneurial and successfully compete in attractive growing markets. But we also look at build versus sale options, hence the disposal of mature savings for £650 million, at a profit of more than £400 million, which will be booked in 2019. Scale-ups are strategic aligned growth businesses where we can be either 100% owners or holders of a significant minority stake. These businesses have the potential to become grown-ups, and as they grow, so we can increase our ownership as part of financing their growth. Cala is a great example of this. It has moved up to the grown-up space, with L&G now, as Jeff mentioned, 100% owners, in effect replacing mature savings. Other businesses where we own minority stakes can likewise be funded to grow. Pemberton in SME lending, NTR in clean, green and cheap energy, ADV, our venture capital partnership with the British Business Bank, Salary Finance and Smarter 365. If, despite growth, the strategic fit is not right, a minority stake can be sold at a profit. For example, India First. Looking now at the 100% owned scale-ups, which are delivering fast growth to Legal & General, these include Build to Rent, LGIM America, LGR America, European ETFs, DC and Retail, and Future Cities. Here you have a set of high performers with strong growth prospects. For example, our total build-to-rent pipeline is now 3,000 homes across 9 schemes nationwide, more than double our pipeline a year ago. Our US businesses, LGRA and LGMA, are similarly well-placed for growth. LGMA, for example, delivered net inflows of £8.3 billion in the US in the first half of this year. Our startups are either 100% owned or companies in which we have a minority stake. The 100% owned startups are developed within the business units. For example, our surveying and insurance businesses. The minority-owned startups, which are in areas connected with our core businesses, which we believe have outstanding potential for growth. As that growth materializes, we increase our stake to help support its growth. We have some terrific startups and scale-ups in Bernie's business, including Salary Finance and Smarter 365, as well as Care Saucer in Chris's LGR retail business. To get more granular about this, here we illustrate the LNG housing ecosystem, driven both by the need for new real assets and the deployment of technology. This encompasses house building across all forms of tenure, for sale, for rent, later living, and affordable. It utilizes the leading market shares we have through LNG Mortgage Club and our leading surveying business, as well as our lifetime mortgage business. House moves are also the natural point for GI and indeed protection transactions, again with a significant data or digital component. We have three other exciting ecosystems which we'll discuss at a later date: workplace, retirement, and real assets. They drive real synergies and collaboration across legal and general. Our growth pyramid had Cala moving from scale-up to grown-up. LNG's investment has facilitated a tripling of revenue in 5 years, a 2.5% increase in housing units delivered, and a 5x increase in EBIT. Operating margins have indeed improved, but they're still only 13% compared to a 21% industry average. The pipeline is strong, with 3,000 units per annum a credible medium-term target. LGMA is likewise in transition from scale-up to grown-up. Initiated with $6 billion of internal assets back in 2007, since 2013, it has successfully attracted U.S. and domestic and international funds and now has over $180 billion under management. Its product range is extending from early significant successes in active fixed income and LDI. We're now building out to index and starting in multi-assets and real assets. And LGMA is now positioned to be one of the drivers of our 8 to 10% growth in LGM. LGM Asia is in the startup bracket. Yes, we've won mandates in Asia, but we're just beginning to scratch the surface in a market that is becoming one of the three pillars of global asset management. We're adding resources and are investing for growth into numerous Asian markets. Like LGMA, LGRA is a 100% subsidiary in the scale-up category. From a standing start in 2015, it has written nearly $2 billion for 28 clients, including $300 million in H1, up from $141 million in H1 2017. The background is a US PRT market estimated at $20 to $25 billion this year, driven by a supportive policy environment and a favorable mortality and rate environment. We are enabling this business to grow by utilizing group-wide infrastructure and real asset capabilities in the United States, as well as leveraging our strengths, including longevity, investment management, and admin expertise. Salary Finance was a startup, which we first invested in 2017. Now clearly a scale-up, where we now have a 40% shareholding. It has 500,000 employees on its platform already, and we expect it to reach 1 million by the end of this year. Because it is a truly digital scale-up business, we can scale up quickly. Salary Finance is intending to launch more widely in the US in H2. More innovation for LNG will follow in all of these areas. All financial services businesses, probably all businesses, full stop, now have to be technology businesses. You've seen some of our digital startup and scale-up investments in our earlier pyramid of growth, but the use of technology is increasing everywhere and at pace across our grown-up businesses too. This includes the cloud, robotics, AI, big data, blockchain, and platforms. The key to this, for us anyway, is focus and delivery, rather than just unveiling technical solutions which are in search of a problem to solve. So we measure carefully, for example, the costs and benefits of unattended and attended robotics. Disruption for us is a responsibility and a privilege. This applies even when we are disrupting ourselves. So the use of big data, for example, in surveying or GI, is not just about pricing, but is also about our customer's journey. For example, being able to solve and secure home cover on any device 24/7 by just answering 5 questions or fewer. Operating an evolutionary model of this sort requires plenty of entry points for companies and businesses as they grow. But it also requires focus on exit, where it is right to exit. In recent years, we've consistently sharpened our focus through a series of disposals, closures, and simplifications. We see these moves through 2 connected lenses, strategic fit and shareholder value. The slide illustrates our exits from businesses which were subscale, underperforming profit or growth terms, or in geographies or segments which did not align to our strategy or our skill set. Since we've started, it has delivered $1.3 billion of cash to invest in higher growth businesses. Turning now to the LGC $8.1 billion asset portfolio, the composition of the portfolio with over $4 billion of cash clearly indicates that there are many optimized opportunities ahead for Kerrigan and the team. We've made very significant progress growing direct investments, which more than doubled since 2015. They now stand at over $2 billion and generated $104 million of operating profit in H1. The direct investments naturally support our PRT business. This is LGC's role as an asset sourcer. The traded and treasury assets portfolio, however, now stands at $6.1 billion, with operating profit of $68 million. We have to deliver more profit from these assets. The standout item here, which Jeff and I have both commented on, is the component of cash, which is well over $4 billion. Reinvesting cash into more productive assets while maintaining a group ROE of over 20% is a clear winning strategy for Legal & General. Given our success to date and the opportunities presented to us, we will be accelerating LGC's evolution in H2 and beyond. I will finish on our financial ambition and strategic goals. Our goal is to replicate the 10% compound annual growth in EPS which we delivered for 2011 to 2015 for the period 2016 to 2020. Halfway through, we're on track to deliver that goal. Our outlook for H2 is confident about moving forward in a material way on each of the strategic goals listed here. We do expect to close a further $7 billion in PRT transactions. We expect workplace AUM to grow further and faster. We expect LGMA to deliver further growth. We will get off the ground in LGM Asia and to expand in housing and urban regeneration across more cities in Britain. We will deliver inclusive capitalism, fulfilling an economically and socially useful role. And we will do that by utilizing all the talents of all of our people and all the strengths of our positive, supportive culture. Now, I'll open up to questions. Can you just mention your name so that people, even though I know who you are, for the camera?
Thanks. It's Andy Sinclair from BofA Merrill Lynch. 3 from me, as usual, please. Firstly, on the pipeline, $7 billion of bulk pipeline in the UK, could you just give some colour on the global opportunities as well? Do you expect a better H2 than H1 globally as well for pension risk transfer? Secondly, sorry, still stay on pension risk transfer. Has pricing or competition changed after the consultation paper on lifetime mortgages? And third, moving across to the insurance business, group protection APE growth ticked up a little bit in the first half of the year. Just wonder if you could comment on pricing trends, outlook here after a few wobbles on the insurance business.
Sure. I'll answer 1, Jeff can answer 2, and Bernie can answer 3. The $7 billion isn't the pipeline. Those are exclusive deals that we expect to close, expect to close either one later this week or early next week. And so the $20 billion that used to be called pipeline is now called actively quoting because of the more explicit definition from our CRO, Mr. Simon Gard, on that particular thing. The pipeline is also very strong in America, but the metrics are not as well developed in America. But certainly the the second half is always stronger than the first half. But I think as Jeff's talked about, and I've certainly talked about, we'll just maintain our financial discipline in America. But there's certainly a bigger pipeline in H2 in both the UK and the United States. And in fact, there's a couple of other countries, Holland and Ireland, also featuring in the pipeline for H2. And indeed, into 2019, the pipeline is also looking very strong in H1 of 2019 as well. And I can see my colleagues at the back nodding their head because they won't be getting much time off over Christmas. Jeff?
Yeah, sure. The pricing competition around LTM. Certainly, we've been reflecting a possible outcome of that consultation within our pricing. And the trustees, the schemes have been accepting of that and understand the logic. Given we've been winning, we therefore assume our competition must be doing the same around that. So it flows through. We can provide the explanation. We can provide the impact on pricing, and it's been accepted.
Bernie?
Yeah, so on group protection, we've been making a number of changes, particularly making our pricing more sophisticated and also addressing customer service. And it's really good to see that that's coming through in new business sales as well. Part of our pricing is putting premiums up, and sometimes we retain schemes, and that all comes through into AP as well. So, yeah, some really encouraging trends in terms of margins and other activity in the market. That's always evolving. We remain more sophisticated and disciplined in our pricing, and we'll be looking to get profitable new business wherever we can.
Thanks, Bernie. I'd like to thank Steve Griffiths and all the team at Group Protection, who've just done an outstanding job for us. I know that Steve's not here today because he's working hard.
Thanks, Alan Devlin from Barclays. Two questions. First of all, on LNG Capital, just picking up on your last point you made. You know, obviously, the cash is growing faster than the in absolute terms than the direct investments. You know, realistically, how quickly and how much can you put into direct investments? That can be a big delta to earnings, as we saw in the first half. And then just secondly, on the lifetime mortgages, just to follow up from Andy's question, obviously not a big impact on your back book because it's a small part of AEM, but what is the impact on the new business margins, because you're adding a lot of it going forward? And also, are you changing your LTM pricing as well as annuity pricing to reflect any changes? And how do you think that the PRA can justify their assumptions?
That's four questions.
Checking anybody. PRA often come to these meetings. They hide somewhere in the back. I'm just looking around to see whether they're here or not. I think the I'll ask Kerrigan to talk about LGC. And I'll just echo some of the points that I'll just go through the lifetime mortgages. You know, it's a very attractive market. And the PRA is trying to stop, in a certain sense, very high loan to value, high rate products for people, and have developed a system which does that, I think, in my view. We don't always get treated the same way as banks on stuff. Hence, we've got a $2.6 billion credit default reserve, which is way higher than any banks would have on an asset portfolio, because we fulfill a different role than banking. We are, you know, structural providers of long-term capital into the industry, so we tend to have more onerous. And other banks think they've got onerous capital rules, but we would have more onerous. And lifetime mortgages are in that area. As Jeff mentioned, it's not a problem for us within the lifetime mortgage business, and it's certainly not a problem as a consequence in the PRT business. We've got lots of upside yet in terms of the amount of assets. We've only got $2 billion out of $56 billion in lifetime mortgages. I don't think in any way was this designed to catch LNG out. I think it was, in a sense, it was more encouragement to LNG in the lifetime mortgage markets. On LGC, Kerrigan, why are you not investing more money when you've got all this money sitting idly around?
Well, I think in Nigel's press book, he talks about changing Britain and the real enduring need for private capital in residential housing across Britain, and indeed economic investment in our great cities outside of London. Certainly an incredible demand for it, and we think a great social and economic purpose to be putting money to work there. Residential housing, we're live on just about 90 sites across the UK. Attractive opportunities for buying land, a lot more that we can do there in sectors such as affordable housing, later living, and indeed, of course, build to sell, where there's an incredible demand for all those and a supportive market broadly across all those markets, and more we can do there certainly. And in the future of our our UK cities, again, about £500 million invested in that £2 billion portfolio. There's a lot of demand as we see regional devolution and people wanting to work with us to apply private capital to their opportunities in whether that's commercial environments, residential environments, or mobility, connectivity, sustainability, all the future of our cities. So we certainly see huge opportunities for growth. My colleagues on stage tell me frequently to invest it wisely. So we will be very careful about the way in which we build out that portfolio, but certainly a huge number of opportunities, and you should expect to see that $2 billion investment grow at a pretty reasonable pace with that backdrop.
No, again, I'd like to thank Kerrigan for moving from LGR to LGC, and that was because he saw the huge opportunities that we have in LGC to grow the business. And along with John Godfrey and Pete Gladwell, who used to do a lot of work with me, Kerrigan, John Cummins, who joined us from RBS, who's made a huge contribution already, and his team. We've got much more resources going into this than we had before, and very highly talented people who are being welcomed in Edinburgh and Glasgow and Newcastle, Bristol, Bath, et cetera, et cetera, Cambridge, Oxford. There's lots of great activity going on, and lots of towns and cities are leaning into Brexit, which is a positive thing. And devolution, regional devolution, and empowerment of these people is really another big positive for us as a firm.
Thanks, Gordon Aitken from RBC. Three questions, please. First on solvency, you're running at 193. It's obviously a lot higher than when you started under Solvency II. Just wonder if you can comment on, you know, what the drivers there. Is it board-driven, regulator-driven, shareholder-driven, or is it just a short-term issue? Second, on equity release, I know you say you already have a robust capital treatment for lifetime mortgages. Just does that mean that you are using a deferment rate which is within what the PRA is talking about, so north of 1%? And just finally, UK bulks, you've got you know, some fantastic opportunities and possibly an alternative opportunity here. So bulks, you've said the strain is less than 4% at the moment, so let's just say it's 3%. Now, you can't run a bulk at 100% solvency, so let's say 140. So the strain after building up the capital requirement, I know that's not how you define strain, but the actual immediate hit on an 18 billion book would be 1.3 billion. Now, there is an 18 billion book out there. the big advantage, you know, that would have over DB schemes is, because of course DB schemes don't come with any capital, this already comes with its capital, and the market's saying that's, you know, priced less than a billion compared to, you know, the 1.3 billion for a DB scheme. Why isn't that more profitable to you than the DB schemes that you're taking on?
There's a man who's got more ambition than I have. I can't believe this is happening. I feel ashamed of my lack of ambition for this particular division. Jeff, do you want to answer one and three? And Chris, can you answer two? You can remember what one and three were.
Yeah, you're going to do the LTM first. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I think there's a number of changes to, sorry, my final question, to the PRA's new sort of proposed basis for lifetime mortgages. So it's a bit hard to compare sort of one to the other. We're going from a sort of quite real-worldy kind of approach to more of a market consistent. Just we're pretty confident, given what we see, that the 1% deferment rate, which is what they're very much sort of steering to, would be really quite a modest impact for us, both on existing business and also for new business, really only on a section of the higher loan-to-value products. More likely to have an impact, I would think, on people offering perhaps slightly lower loan-to-values for similar interest rates in the future.
Okay, Jeff?
Yeah, sure. The 193%, I'd categorise it more as a natural evolution, to be honest. It's not that it's targeting anything in particular or we're aiming at that. You know, there's been some rise in interest rates, though they're still reasonably low. You know, that drives some of it. Obviously, a lot more sophistication in managing the metric, and the likes of Tim and those in the LGR team in particular, optimizing matching adjustment on an ongoing basis, optimizing that asset portfolio, that helps to drive it. Refinements in the model on an ongoing basis, which have moved that higher. So, you know, we have surplus generation also, which we haven't been spending, which we're seeing in other parts of the balance sheet. So there's a general evolution of it, and you know, we keep it under review. We don't think it's too high yet. We think it gives us great optionality to write things like 7 billion plus of PRT deals. Whether it gives us optionality to write 18 billion is another question. I think the question is more of the attraction, relative attraction. We're always interested in large transactions around annuities. However, when we can write 7 billion plus of PRT, whilst maintaining our pricing discipline, we believe using a lot of the advantages we have, whether that's relationships, the asset side of the balance sheet, whether it's more bespoke transactions, then we believe that also drives a lot of efficiency for us. So it would have to be reasonably compelling, and we'd look at other things apart from just the capital strain associated with that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Colm Kelly, UBS. Two questions, one on the cash generation or the release of operations, as it's called. I suppose that used to be the core cash metric to communicate the sustainability of the dividend strategy. Looking at the growth rate of that since 2017, each half year it's 0%, 2%, minus 8. Now, I appreciate there's impacts in there. The back book cash generation has been flat. What has changed, or why should I not be looking at that metric as continuing to be key for the dividend sustainability? That's the first question. Second question, apologies if I didn't pick up the answer earlier to the new business margin impact from the equity release consultation. If you could just comment on that. I know you have the numbers done and it's not material for the solvency, but for the new business margin impact, that would be useful. Thank you.
Well, zero for the second one. I think you want to take the...
Yeah, I was going to say zero for the second. We're flowing it through to pricing, as I said. So, you know, we anticipate that going through. It's still a really attractive asset from a funding perspective for the annuity portfolio. So, you know, we would see that flowing through. In terms of release from operations, as you say, there's a lot of moving parts been going on there, mix of business, the mature savings dropping out. And so, you know, that then drives changes in what you see on the release from operations, and even things like FX flow through on LGI. And so there are always movements on that metric. We look at release from operations, we look at net release from operations. Obviously, we anticipate that being significantly higher when you add in a large amount of PRT business in the second half. And we see good growth in these metrics on an ongoing basis. We also look at Solvency II surplus generation. That's why we gave the exact number and growth for the operational surplus generation, 11%, clearly bigger than 7%. We then have a new business strain, and we can manage that. We can offset against longevity releases, et cetera. So we look at that number as well. And obviously the normal up-profit PBT metrics. So we look at a range of these. I've already said to a few other people, I'm thinking we'll do a bit more cash-type disclosure at the year-end because the figure is big. What is it? And relating that to what are we paying out from entities. But it never quite has landed at the half year. It's much cleaner to do it at the full year. So we'll look at a number of these metrics and give a bit more cash type disclosure.
Okay. Oliver Steele, Deutsche Bank. So first question is on...
How many questions you got, Oliver?
Three.
Three, okay. Feel better.
So first question is on direct investments you're warehousing within LGR. Can you remind us how much you built that up by last year, how much you've added to that this year? And I suppose basically what I'm looking for is some helpful indicator towards the sort of new business margin you might expect on the 7 billion plus of pipeline you've got on the second half. Second question is the SCR came down, I think, 300 million. You talked in the couple of questions ago about sort of management actions you've taken. Is that what drove it, and how much more have you got to do on that front? And then finally, with reference to slide 29, that's the sort of interlinking on the all of the housing activities that you've got. How much cross-selling are you actually doing between those various parts, i.e., you know, Cala homes to new mortgages, new protection policies? How much existing mortgages are moving into equity release mortgages? Anything you can give us on that?
Yeah, I'll do one and three, Jeff, if you do two on this. You know, the direct investments, we obviously warehouse direct investments the following year, and those typically cover a large proportion of what we want to complete during the following year. So we had that in hand. we knew we had a huge pipeline of customer business, which in a certain sense was one of the reasons we didn't press overly hard on the very large backbook transaction earlier in the year. We'd have been quite happy to take $3 billion of it, like Aegon, but we had so much customer business that we wanted to focus on the customer business. And to be fair to the deal team, they just done a great job of doing that. The sorts of assets that we're getting are similar to last year, and the margin itself on the deals will be much more related to the duration of the liabilities that we've taken on rather than the quality of the assets that we have in the portfolio. And as Jeff mentioned, the movement between what gets shared between us and the customers is similar going forward. So we won't see material differences from the margins that we expected on the back book. In terms of slide 29, the synergies exist not in, you know, kind of selling a few more mortgages for our business. If you take build to rent, you know, build to rent is generally something that creates synergies between all three divisions, where Elgin are trying to build and will indeed, I think, succeed in building the first institutionally funded asset class around housing. LGC are obviously providing the equity capital to kickstart that all those schemes going in partnership with PGGM, who are great partners for us and have lots of expertise in this area. And once we structure those portfolios, LGR will take a cash flow based matching adjustment approach to getting assets which fit the portfolio. I could go through all of the others, and at some point we'll arrange a presentation where we'll go through all the ecosystems, how things are joined up together. But that's probably the best example of how we're currently working together. And, you know, investing in new real assets, which we can structure in such a way that they benefit LGC, LGIM, and LGR. And urban regeneration, we've talked about Cardiff and Leeds and Manchester before. There's more of that going to happen because we have much more capability to do that, which was really what Kerrigan was saying in the answer to his answer to the earlier question. Jeff?
On the SCR, I mean, there's no single big driver of that. You know, there'll be an element of rate, there'll be an element of slight changes in diversification and what we would have as our Bighton scenario, as we call it. You know, there'll be elements of small pieces along the line where we're optimizing model changes on an ongoing basis, et cetera. That, as you saw in the op variance, there was a whole load of things which just sort of cancelling out. But in terms of how many of those do we have to go, I mean, there's a long way to go of evolution. We're constantly optimizing. So what does it do for capital? What do? Do we use an internal reinsurance? Do we change the structures that we have for external risk transfer, et cetera? So there's a long way to go on those that always add and benefit on that, and understanding how it all diversifies in the model and what optimizes it, what mixes a business, et cetera, would be a long way to go around that. And we'll see there'll still be material areas where we believe we can improve the model and simply bring the SCR down, and PRA will have a few where they think it goes up.
So I'll ask you two and then A and B. Just on the home, the combined ratio of 92, if my memory serves me correct, it used to be running around 94, 95. That's 92, Stephen Weather. Now, you've done a whole bunch of new deals. I assume you would have had to bid up for the deals. I would have expected the combined ratio to have gone up, given all the other net rates in the market, et cetera. So, why have you got such a favorable ex-weather combined ratio? And are there any other sort of bulk distribution deal costs that aren't included in the combined ratio, say, below the line in your startup spend or something like that? That's question one. The second one is Just was forced to, between its March results and its disclosures, solely to convert its equity release portfolio to change the internal ratings from AA to single A. I was wondering, you know, if you've had conversations with the PRA around your sort of circa $13 billion direct investments and the ratings on that, and if there's any risk from that. And the third question is, I was surprised by that mature savings operating profit in the first half. I was wondering, is there going to be any further contribution in the second half from that element?
If Cheryl takes the first question, Kerrigan, I'll do a little introduction, then you take the second question, Jeff takes the third question. Cheryl, do you want to just answer the first question?
Thank you. Our combined ratio has continued to improve, excluding weather, because we have been much more strong in our pricing discipline and our risk selection, and we've also been rebalancing our portfolio. So we've reduced our exposure to broker business and increased it to the direct. And going back to your point about the acquisition of the new deals, and they're being reflected in the combined ratio too.
Okay, thank you. Just in terms of in the old days, we used to go and get every deal that we did in direct investments, have a non-objection from the regulator. We've moved on since then because we've gained the trust of the regulator. So we certainly had no discussion on the rating of the lifetime mortgage book. But Kerrigan, is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I guess just reflecting on the slide that we showed earlier, showing the top 10 LGR direct investments, there could be the LGC ones also. There's a very robust internal ratings process that's been agreed and discussed with the PRA extensively. We have an independent team based in Elgium filled with experts. Our group credit risk officer sits on as part of that. So it's a very substantial process across a really diverse set of assets, so we're very comfortable with those into that internal rating process, and no reason to expect any wholesale shift in what we're doing there.
No, I think our internal rating committee give the team a particularly hard time and seem to enjoy giving Mark Kerrigan and others who have to appear in front of them a particularly difficult time.
And the material savings is relatively straightforward. It's just an accounting thing. We're not allowed to realize all of the profit from the transaction until the Part 7. Therefore, we sort of amortize that, if you like. It comes out whilst we're still on a reinsurance state rather than a Part 7. So we expect the underlying, the 20 to 25 million to each half year until we get to that Part 7 as it just unwinds.
Okay. Andrew? Then we'll come back.
Hello, it's Andrew Green, Autonomous. Could I ask three questions? Firstly, could you give a slightly more numerical answer to the what the impact of a 1% deferment rate is, and also the growth rate in the direct investments from 2 billion? What sort of growth rate per annum are you looking at? Secondly, your ambition to grow earnings to 2020 by 10%, the dividend still growing at 7. Should we expect A to come up to B or B to come down to A? And thirdly, could you talk a little bit about the supposed toxic culture in Elgium? And particularly, that would be a concern to me if it involves the area which is doing internal ratings.
Indeed it would, if that were true. I'll take the culture thing first, if I may, and then, Jeff, if you take the second question. Kerrigan, I think you've got to come back and give a better answer on the growth of DI. I'm very proud of everything that Mark and the team have achieved over a number of years in Elgium. And any time we have any whistleblowing across the group, we, in a sense, our culture is about actively encouraging whistleblowing for people to come forward and in a very anonymized way if there are issues that they want to raise. It's part of our openness as a firm. We have a policy which says every non-executive can go to any management meeting anywhere in the world at any time. Our regulators, including Sam Woods and Megan Butler from the PRA and the FCA, sit in on a whole day in the life of LNG, and so they see how we work, starting with the 7 o'clock management meetings in Elgium and finishing up in the call centres late at evening listening to calls. So we want to be totally transparent about all of this. It's unfortunate these things have got in the media, relating to incidents that happened in 2017, but they have. But rest assured, we're totally convinced and know that we have a positive, supportive culture here. We had an independent review from Latham Watkins, which assessed our culture, and it came out as positive, supportive, and respectful. Any firm at any time will have a number of whistleblowers, and we're no different from anybody else around that. And we've actively encouraged our whistleblowers to come forward. And there's an independent review of whistleblowers carried out by our internal audit function once a year. And in every year that I've been here, that's turned out to be a good report. and supportive report of the things that we're trying to do as a firm. I don't know, Mark, whether you want to add anything to what I've just said.
Yeah, I mean, I think I guess I would just encourage everyone to look at this topic as comprehensively as possible and focus on facts. I mean, things can be alleged, you know, at any time, and how it the press chooses to portray it, we can't control. But we have an outstanding culture in LGM. It's something that we take pride in. We know it drives absolutely everything in our business, every aspect of our business. It's what we're primarily known for, I think, with our brand in the marketplace. And, you know, situations like this are actually really unifying for the employees. I spent most of the last couple of weeks talking with employees and clients, and it's just been an extremely, you know, supportive, understanding situation. Not to say we don't have situations that come up, not to say that there's always going to be issues in a large organization, like Nigel mentioned, and we'll continue to address them, you know, within, you know, the control framework that we have. And in this situation, you know, I think it acted the way it was intended to do independent investigation and try to bring closure to the activities that were alleged.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Jeff, do you want to just go through the lifetime mortgage
and the dividend?
And the dividend. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the lifetime mortgage, we're not going to give any more on the numbers. You can't just look at it at the deferment. You have to look at how do you structure it in the SPV, et cetera. How does it flow through MA to get your total capital implications? So, you know, we're perfectly happy it's not material to group capital, and there's others that will be worse off than us on that number. So we don't need to sort of cover that further, we don't think. The 10% versus 7%, well, we made a pretty clear statement about sustainable medium-term 7%. We've only done it once, so it probably would make sense to have a record if it's sustainable medium-term of doing that. There's no magic number about the 10% versus the 7%, and I've said a number of times we look at the whole range of metrics. We don't just look at earnings, and we use some of that headroom for investment. We look at what else we can do with it, and we look at Solvency II. We look at our capital position. We look at our cash position. We look at earnings on other basis. How much are we generating? So there isn't a magic between the two on those.
I'll give you a slightly better figures then. Just in terms of H1, gross new investment for direct investment in the portfolio was just over 700 million. Obviously, Cala was over 300 million of that. Net new investment, round about the 500 million level, or just over the 500 million level. As Nigel said, we've certainly got the team, the quality, the capability, the bandwidth, and the opportunities to keep exploring opportunities at that rate. So that would be the rate of opportunity discovery, precisely which ones we'll do and when. It will inevitably be a little bit lumpy.
Okay. Just work our way around.
Hi, Andrew Baker, Citi. Just two questions, please. So, first one, in a growing bulk market, you're seeing some competitors do some larger longevity transactions. You've got your $7 billion second half pipeline. Are you seeing any longevity reinsurance capacity concerns, either this year or just your longer term outlook on the capacity there? And then, secondly, you're obviously further down looking at IFRS 17. Are you in a position to give an updated view on what you see high-level potential impacts on that? Thank you.
Okay. On the longevity, we've seen no capacity issues whatsoever. And so we're very happy with the relationships we've had. In a certain sense, in the protection market, we've seen no capacity issues at all for the last 25 years. And so we've been doing it on one side of the business for a long time, and on the other side, we're absolutely fine. Jeff, do you want to take the second question?
Yeah, I mean, IFRS 17, we're doing lots of work. We're comfortable, and as we've said before, it actually has limited impact in terms of back book versus new business profits, et cetera, because of the way it works. But it's a reasonable distance off, and all the latest debate is there 11 or 14 issues that need to be changed? So which version of IFRS 17 and when it's coming in is probably the question. So our focus remains implementing efficiently, not burning money, trying to bring something in until we get enough clarity, but being far enough advanced and improving our technology so that we can implement it. But yeah, we're not nervous about the accounting implications at this stage, and we wait for more clarity to talk about it when we get there.
Okay. I think we have four more questions here, and so if there's any more than the four more questions here, can people put their hands up? Because I think we've got four more questions here to answer. Multiple questions to answer.
Morning, John Hocking from Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please. First of all, annuities. Can you talk a little bit about how you're pricing for longevity? You're actually already taking CMI16 into pricing for new business, or actually being moved even ahead of CMI16, first question. Secondly, could you give us an update, please, on what's happening with LNG homes? Is that up and running? Are you still sort of test manufacturing? You're actually full launch there. And then finally, it's on lifetime mortgages. You've obviously built fantastic origination capacity there very quickly. Is there an outcome from the PRA review that makes it less attractive for backing the annuities? And is there actually a role for it in the balance sheet, even if it's not actually that interesting anymore from an annuity perspective?
Yeah, I'll answer the third one, which is no. I mean, it's still, I think Jeff made that point earlier on, in terms of lifetime mortgages, they remain incredibly attractive for us, anyway, in terms of the backwards accounts, and about the competitors around that. If Kerrigan answers two and you answer one, Jeff, if that's okay. Kerrigan on two, homes.
Great. Just on modular homes, well, I'm sure we all know the strategic reasons for being there. Anybody in residential house building as part of a real assets portfolio needs an answer to the significant skill shortage we already see on building sites around the country. That's getting worse. You might be thinking Brexit, but aging demographic in the workforce on site is a very significant feature there. So you need an answer to address that skill shortage as we go from 200,000 to 300,000 houses, and taking that construction off-site and putting it in a factory and doing 80% of the build there makes a lot of sense from a strategic rationale. We are already producing live houses that people will live in, with the first set of houses, first four houses now on our Butler's Park site in Crowthorne.
Jeff? Yeah, on longevity and pricing, obviously for PRT business, in the UK, we reinsure a vast majority of it. So the more important question is, what are the reinsurers doing? We continue to see very aggressive terms. You know, we think they're already being forced, because of competition reasons, to factor in a lot of this, the slowdown in longevity improvement, into their pricing. So that naturally flows through in that. Obviously, for the individual retail annuities, we very careful in anticipating where we think the basis will be, and Chris wants to be more aggressive. He still knows he's only going to be reporting it on what we've actually implemented by the year end. So we have to balance that at any point in time.
Okay. Three. Yep. Okay. Any order?
Thank you. Don Maimani, Exane BNP Paribas. Three questions for me, all on PRT. The first is, so 2018 is going to be a great year in terms of volumes for the market. You're excited about H1 2019. And I think we all understand the sort of the structural drivers. What I'm trying to get my head around is whether the sort of the recent dramatic improvement in funding positions is creating a surge in 2018, early 2019, which will then settle down and then revert to a sort of a long-term growth, whether actually you see this as a sort of a step change. The second question on pricing, it sounds like H2 is going to be dominated by very large ticket items. Does that affect the pricing dynamic and the capital strain dynamic, or actually would you essentially expect it to be similar to last year? And then finally, in terms of pricing and capital strain on non-UK business, are there any different dynamics there that we should be aware of? Thank you.
The markets are so big, and as more deals get done and our capacity to do more deals and bigger deals has increased, by definition, our clients have, some of them have 5, 10, 15, 20 billion that they want to do. We've done bits of that so far. So some of it's definitely repeat business with existing clients. We do have 400 billion of LDI business that we've done in previous years. So the hopper is enormous, and we've created a similar hopper, as you know, in the United States. We knew coming into the year end, that's why we had all that DI, that we were going to have a very busy year. To be fair, it's a bit busier than we thought, but it's still within the parameters of being the direction of travel is the same. I think people are thinking that the market could go from 20 to 40 billion in any given year, and there's still a few back books to do. So there's not a shortage of demand from clients. And there's a similar picture in the United States. There's a very full hopper of things that need doing. We can't be absolutely certain, but certainly, you know, 2019, the first half of that, which we have reasonable visibility on already, is also very busy for the deal team. Do you want to add some color on the pricing and capital, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it isn't just large ticket. I mean, we have a number of deals that we're in these discussions on, and they're, you know, the dynamics change all the time on the pricing. You know, it will be sometimes people see a big deal as really attractive, they really want to do it, and they're less interested in smaller deals, and the smaller deals look more attractive to us. So it does move around quite often, which is a tricky one to explain to the board, actually. You tell them one strategy and then it's another. So then in terms of the non-UK, the dynamics are pretty similar. We ourselves are very conscious of using economic capital in our pricing for that. So in terms of return hurdles on an economic capital, they're very similar. We're newer to the market, so we're therefore a bit more wary on what we report to make sure that we're just being slightly more conservative on that. But in terms of return targets and economic profit, they're sort of similar.
I think one of the other lucky things we've got, I mean, you know, we've got the likes of Simon Gard and Tim Steadman, who've been around forever. And having been up and down the cycles, we all lived through, you know, we've got long-term knowledge of the way the markets have moved. So rest assured, their heartbeats never get above about 65 when we're discussing any of this stuff. And so we're very measured in our approach and never get overly excited about stuff at their level. I get a bit excited about it at times, and Jeff's starting to get excited. And, of course, Kerrigan's been with us a long time and worked on the LDI business for a long time as well. So there's a great team. There's a very experienced team that are dealing with all of these issues. But, three questions to go.
Hi, it's Abid Hussain from Credit Suisse. Just two questions if I can. Firstly, coming back to PRT, why do you think the PRT deals have been skewed towards H2 this year? Is there something peculiar going on during H1? And then what proportion of deals in exclusivity do you typically close? Is it 100%? And then second question on direct assets. How are the yields on your liquid assets tracking relative to traded assets? Have you seen any compression or are they stable relative to last year?
Yeah, I think the answers to all those things are positive. And so we've got a great origination capability in DI assets. So I'm very, very happy with all of that. And so anything else you want to add, Jeff?
I don't think there's anything magical about H1 versus H2. Deals take a while to land. You know, there's a lot of discussion that needs to go on. I don't think there's anything there. As Nigel says, we're already in conversations about things for Q1 19. That could easily then move to Q2 19, et cetera. So, you know, I don't think there's anything magical there. Percentage exclusivity. You know, we're confident it's...
We had 10 deals last year, which at the beginning of H2 were exclusive, and the team delivered all 10. So they were 10 for 10, the 10 for 10 last year. And I'm sure that's the kiss of death. And I can see them all they're all glaring at me, and will give me a hard time tonight when this is all finished. But so far, so good. And if there's a bit of wood around, I'd touch it. But we usually have a very high conversion rate. Clearly, there's some macro exogenous things happen which are outside our control or the client's control, then things tend to fall away, but they rarely fall away perpetually. They come back, you know, maybe 12, 18 months or 2 years, 2 years later. Barry.
Morning, it's Barry Corns at Panmure Gordon. I've got three questions, if I may. First of all, back to lifetime mortgages. I think you talked about the market of $6 billion by 2020. Just wondered if that's a slowdown. I thought maybe Steve Ellis may have given a sort of bigger figure. I wonder if that's related to the consultation paper. So your outlook on lifetime mortgages, please. Second question, LG, when you had the Capital Markets Day, there was about to be launch a retail savings campaign. That seems gone relatively quiet. Just wondered if you could comment on that, please. And thirdly, on the GI side, obviously you talked about weather in Q1, but just wondered if the your escape of water claims from previous years have, forgive the pun, but have dried up.
I'll let Cheryl answer the third one. Mark, if you want to answer the second one. On the first one, Steve Ellis is my sort of guy. I mean, you've got all the compliance people who just give you a hard time about future projections, so we always have to err on the very cautious to prudent side, but I think the market could be a lot bigger going forward, and certainly the FCA have been encouraging that, the Treasury encourages that. This is very good for the economy. I think there's only 2,000 agents out of the 7,000 agents which are trained to sell the product, are actually selling the product so far. And if just Chris and the team could just get out and do a bit more hustling, then clearly we would have an even bigger and more successful business going forward. Cheryl, do you want to go next, and then Mark?
Just on escape of water. So it's an industry-wide issue. It's a peril, just like theft and fire. Last year, we had a higher number of claims than we anticipate. We are pricing now at the right levels and choosing the right risks.
Okay. Mark?
Excuse me. We didn't intend to have a big bang approach to launching our newer direct investment business, but we did launch it with a new ad campaign, Own Your World, which you saw some of the I'm sure you've seen it around town, and you've seen it earlier in the presentation slides. So positioning our brand in the marketplace, adjusting pricing on some of the existing funds, launching some new funds, especially some of the more thematic future world funds in that range, improving the customer experience, tracking metrics more effectively. We're seeing some really positive trends. Hal and I were just talking about this morning. And there'll be another series of ads and so forth in September. So there'll be a series of steps that will continue to occur over the next year and on an ongoing basis. So very much looking at this, you know, in that context, not just a big bang one-time launch.
Okay, thank you. Saving the best for last.
Hi, Ashik Musadi from JP Morgan. Just a couple of questions. Jeff, you mentioned about warehousing assets for the expected volumes. Can you just get some thought on how does the mechanic for the profit booking work? So are the warehousing assets in LGR currently earning profits in LGR, which will move to the new business, or how does the mechanics for the profit booking work for warehousing assets for future business? So that would be good. The second one is, LGM assets, you still see very strong positive flows. I mean, 14 billion in the first half. Having said that, I mean, you have lost around 30 billion of assets in index funds, which is one of your core business, whereas we always hear as an analyst that there is a massive shift from active to passive. So what is the dynamic not working here in UK, or is it that some of your active index fund is moving towards, say, structured solutions or something like that? Any thoughts on that?
Okay. Mark, you want to take the second question? Jeff, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, the asset one's relatively straightforward. We basically haven't allocated it to back the annuity portfolio. Therefore, the warehouse simply sits on the balance sheet at the market value in the annuity business. When we allocate that to back it, it flows through the IFRS, either in new business surplus where we put it, or if we put it to the in-force, it would come through an investment variance. So we haven't allocated that yet. We're not taking account of those yield uplifts compared to the underlying portfolio.
Because we designate business that we know we're probably going to get, we don't have to book the profit. So we don't. That's why we carry the positive, but non-booked DI gain. So we physically know which deals were highly likely. So we align them to those deals pre the year end, and it's always been our policy to do that. Mark?
With regard to the index flows, so looking back on where this business started, it was predominantly in UK DB equities, and obviously that's in structural runoff as those plans are de-risking. And so that's what's driving and has been driving for a while the sustained net outflows in our index funds, not every year, but frankly most years since I've been in the job. But meanwhile, those clients are going into a broadening range of LDI solutions. Our percentage market share has gone up from low 20s to around 30%. So you can think of that as a shift out of equities into a broadening range of LDI solution strategies, ultimately into some kind of buyout situation if they can afford it and want to do that. Then meanwhile, we are growing our index business in all other channels. So we're seeing positive net flows in other channels, in other regions, the core building blocks for our multi-asset products, which show up as multi-asset solutions, but they're building blocks for those products. But we do have to accelerate the growth in these other markets and channels to offset this, what will be continued structural outflows in the UK DB equity space.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd just like to echo one of the points Mark made there. We have a multi-asset team, which has just done a tremendous job. Emil, John, and the rest of the team have just done a great job. But they have a huge opportunity because it's tons of white space to expand into. And Mark's done a great job leading the diversification of the portfolio. Away from, if we'd just been in DB Index, we wouldn't be enjoying being a trillion-pound AUM company right now. So great credit to all of the team within that LG. I'd just like to say thank you to all my colleagues yet again for the great efforts in H1. I'm amazed so many of them have been able to turn up to this particular presentation. They're not hard at work at their desks, and I'll be wandering around in about 15 minutes' time just checking up on everybody. And thank all of you for your questions and your interest today. And we do remain confident about H2, and we'll see you all again in March. Thank you.